Good morning, church. It is indeed good to be here today, to be gathered as God's people, to be gathered in His presence, to spend time in worship and praise and thanksgiving. What a blessing that is. It has been an exciting week for me. Something we did not mention today, but you probably need to know. Some of you know Dulce, who she and her four boys have been coming with us on mostly Wednesday nights for a meal. And she was baptized just a few weeks ago. And Friday night, she got married. She married David Matias, who is the father of her two youngest sons. And she has never been married, and he has never been married. And this is progress. And it was my first bilingual wedding service because David does not speak English. And so I'll tell you what I told him. David, puedes besar a tu esposa. You may kiss your wife. And not right now. But that was about all I can remember from that whole thing. But it was, it's a right step. And we are thankful for Dulce, thankful for David, and pray blessings on their family going forward. Excited about that. Fall is one of my very, very favorite times of year. It is my favorite time of year. We get the cooler weather, but it's not cold and rainy most of the time. We get the beautiful yellows and reds and oranges and the turning foliage, which is great. And we get great holidays like Halloween and Thanksgiving, two of my very favorites, and that lead us on towards Christmas, which is many of your favorites. But I will confess that those are not my only reasons for liking autumn, because I am also a football fan, and all year long I am looking forward to seeing my favorite team and seeing some exciting games. So what do you do when your team is the Titans? What do you do when your team is terrible? And I don't mean like, you know, not as good as you wish they were, not going to make the playoffs, not going to win half their games. I mean worst offense in the league, only won one game, has no quarterback, traded away two of their best players in the middle of the season. Bad, bad, bad. What do you do when that's your team? Some of you have been there, Kentucky fans, you know what I'm talking about. Some of you have been there with your favorite pro team or college team or even high school team. I mean, if you're a Coffee County fan, you've seen some really bad years. Not this year, thankfully, but you've been through what it's like to pull for an organization or a team that is in disarray, right? Whether it's basketball or football or baseball or whatever it may be, whatever your sport may be. What do you do when it's just awful? Now imagine that you're in the midst of one of those terrible seasons, and you get the chance to sit down and ask a few questions of someone in charge, the owner or the general manager or the athletics director, someone in charge of this whole mess, right? What would you ask them if you got a chance to do that, right? Maybe something along the lines are how can you stand to look at that, right? You might ask them, how can you stand to see all that terrible coaching and playing or whatever it might be? Or when are you going to do something to fix this mess? I mean, that's what I would want to ask. That's the questions I would have kind of on the tip of my tongue. So here we are. We've been going through this study in on Sunday morning. And we sit here in our nice clothes. And we've got a nice climate-controlled building, comfortable, padded seats, all that stuff, carpet on the floor. You're well-fed. Some of you came to breakfast, and you're here, and you're real well-fed. But we're surrounded by people who love us, or at least tolerate us without saying anything too offensive. But we know this morning that the whole world is not like that. That what we have here this morning is not the way the rest of the world is. We know for a fact that not too far from here, someone is waking up who doesn't have enough food or who doesn't have a safe roof over their heads. We know that someone this morning is not far from here lying in pain in bed, suffering because they have an illness or an injury and they can't afford the medication or they can't afford a visit to the hospital. We know that not far from here, someone is living in fear of violence and harm from the people who live around them. So the way it is in here is not the way it is out there all the time, is it? In short, as much as we love what's going right in here, there's a lot going wrong out there. More than we can deal with. More than we can fix. More even than we know about. Right? Because sometimes things may look good from our perspective and really be difficult. So what would you do if you had a chance to ask God about it? What would you do if you had a chance to sit down with the owner, so to speak? What would you ask God about the wrongness of our world? As we continue our study through the Minor Prophets, we come to this little book of Habakkuk, and we're just going to spend 1 week on it. We're going to kind of fly through this because I just want us to get an overview. But this little book is probably not one you've read before. If you're just reading the highlights of the Bible, it's sort of tucked away at the end of the Old Testament, and it's less a prophetic preaching. This is not like a sermon, like some of the prophets we've read, you know, they go out and they preach these lessons, and people listen to them, often reject them, and they come back, and they have these prophecies about the future and all that. But this is not like that. This is less a prophetic preaching book and more like a sit-down conversation with God. And as Habakkuk looks out at his world, at the world around him, at all that's going on all out there, he has some questions of God. Questions that are very like the ones you and I might like to ask God if we got a chance to sit down. And he starts off in the first chapter with the first of these questions. He goes, "How long, Lord, must I call for help, but you don't listen? Or cry out to you violence, but you do not save? Why do you make me look at injustice," right? Walking down the street, it's everywhere. "Why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrongdoing? Destruction and violence are before me. There is strife and conflict abounds. Therefore, the law is paralyzed and justice never prevails. So that the wicked hem in the righteous, so that justice is perverted." I'm looking out at the world, Habakkuk says, and it's just awful. It is just awful. There's violence and injustice and there's wrongdoing, there's strife and there's conflict. And the law, the tool that you gave to us is supposed to lead us and regulate us as a people, as an individual, as a society. The law that you gave us, this tool seems paralyzed to do anything about it. We've got the law and we've still got all this badness out here. So what about it, God? How long are you going to sit back and do nothing? That's what Habakkuk's asking. God, you gave us the law. The law's not fixing this. We need you, and we've been asking for you, and you are apparently not doing anything about it. So what's God going to say? How will God answer? How can God answer, right? These accusations that are being made against him. But God does answer. God answers Habakkuk, and this is what he says. "Look at the nations and watch." All right, we're off to a good start here. "And be utterly amazed, for I'm going to do something in your days that you would not believe, even if I told you." I mean, pause right there. This sounds really good, right? This sounds better than good. So amazing that God that's going to be doing all this. So what's this amazing thing that God's going to do? How is he going to fix all these problems with violence and such? Keep reading, and he says, "I'm raising up the Babylonians." Whoa, pause. Put on the brakes. The Babylonians are as bad or worse than anybody else he's been talking about. Are you saying that you're raising up the Babylonians because they're going to be better? Like you're going to fix the Babylonians and they're going to come in here and be the good guys? Nope. That ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth and seize dwellings that are not their own. I'm going to fix the problems you're describing, God says, by making things worse. Much, much worse. I mean, imagine that you have a house that you bought from a guy. He builds you this house and you're like, look, this plumbing is just bad. I mean, we're getting, brown water and we can't flush the toilets and things are going wrong. I really need you to fix this house that you gave me. And they're like, I've got good news. Next week we're going to come and we're going to peel the roof off. Would you think, oh, thank goodness I contacted the contractor. Thank goodness I got in with the owner so they can come and fix. That's what it sounds like to Habakkuk. We've got a problem with violence, and God says, I understand that. I'm going to bring things in, or bring in these Babylonians, and things are going to be much, much worse. You've been under, and remember this from our history lessons, you've been under the vassalship of the Assyrians. Assyrians have basically been in control of Judah. And so you've been under the Assyrians, but the Assyrians are now losing power. They're still ruthless. They're still awful. The Assyrians are losing power, though. He says, you've been under the Assyrians. You think that was bad? That is nothing compared to what I have in store for you. Because I am bringing in the Babylonians, and they're going to rule over you. And they are so much stronger, so much faster, so much better equipped to keep you right under their thumb. It doesn't sound like much of an answer, does it? Certainly not the one that you would want or I would want, or certainly not the one Habakkuk was asking for. But here's the thing. Whether we understand it or not, whether we like it or not, God is in control. In fact, I want you to say that with me. God is in control. That's right. Not the kings, not the armies, not the rich and powerful, not the courts, not the legislatures, not the electoral college, nobody is in control but God. God is in control, and God's plans are so much bigger and more complicated and farther reaching that us standing there trying to grasp at God's plans, it's almost laughable. It's like giving a baby a calculus book and saying, hey, let's learn some math, right? It's just so far beyond us. And the people of God, as the people of God, we have to learn to do what Habakkuk does right here. And that is, number one, we have to be comfortable asking. Go to God and ask. God's not mad that Habakkuk asks him these questions. God's not mad that Habakkuk sees what's wrong with the world and challenges them. God's not upset with that. We have to be comfortable asking. And then number two, very important, equally important, we have to be comfortable not understanding the answer. We have to be comfortable asking. We have to be comfortable not understanding the answer. God will answer his people's cries. It is in his very nature. From the beginning of the Bible all the way to the end, you see when God's people cry out, God answers. But often those answers are not on our time, or they are not what we are expecting out of God, not what we want out of God. Those answers don't fit what we're asking for. And sometimes, even when they give us an answer, God gives us an answer, it's really hard to understand. So we may be tempted to take this non-answer, the answers we don't like or understand, really tempted to take this non-answer as either indifference that God doesn't really care what's going on, or as permission for us to just plow ahead. And let's be honest. That's most often what we're tempted to do. I asked God for this, and I didn't get this right now, so I'm just going to plow on ahead, right? But God's non-answers are neither one of those things. It is God reminding us that He is God, that He is in control, and we are not. That God is there and has a plan, and whatever plan we have is no good. That's what God's non-answers are. But it is also a reminder that we are His, that we belong to Him. And Habakkuk gets that. So he comes back at God. After God's first answer here about the Babylonians, he comes back at the end of chapter 1, bleeding on into the first of chapter 2, and he asks God for clarification. He said, okay, God, I hear you. You say you're raising up the Babylonians. I'm going to give you an analogy. And he gives an analogy about the people are like fish. And the, you know, all the bad people are coming along like a fisherman, just dropping the net and wrangling everybody up and dropping the net and bringing everybody up. And he's like, God, how long are you going to allow these evil people to fish us out? How long are you going to allow the evil people to take us and gut us, right? And God, I don't know the answer to that, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to get up here on the wall, I'm going to get at my post, and I'm just going to wait. And once again, God returns to him. And this time he brings a list of woes. There's five woes if you go through chapter 2 and you want to catch up on that. But he's describing all the things that are going to go terribly, terribly wrong for the violent and the greedy, which includes the Babylonians, by the way. It includes the Assyrians, but it also specifically includes the people of Jerusalem. All the people who are causing all the harm Habakkuk sees, God's list of woes incorporates them. And so it sounds like more badness, but sort of couched in these woes, God gives Habakkuk some gentle guidance. And this is what he says. Says, see, the enemy is puffed up. His desires are not upright, but the righteous person will live by faithfulness. The righteous person will live by faithfulness. You see, the real question here isn't about God and evil. Now, you and I, we come to this book and we start reading, and we're like, oh, this is a book about God and the problem of evil. If you ever do any moral philosophy or any study about that, that's one of the big ones out there. Like, what does God do about all the evil in the world? If God is all powerful and God is all good and God is all loving, then why doesn't God just fix all the bad stuff that's out there? How can there be both an all-powerful and all-loving God and the presence of evil in this world? It's a moral philosophy problem. And that's what the book of Habakkuk looks like. Like, God, why are you allowing, looking at, seeing, and not doing anything about all this badness? But the real question in Habakkuk is not about God and evil. The real question that we sort of get to through this conversation is not about God, it's about us. Because you see, God is faithful. God is there. God is always faithful, always good, always present. But us, we're finicky. We're flighty, we might say. We're a little unsteady. So when you ask God if he will be faithful to his promises, God is asking you, will you be faithful until he does? God, you're asking God, will you be faithful to your promise? And God says, will you remain faithful until I do? Because I'm always faithful. I'm going to be there. I'm going to hold to my word just like I always have. And he gives some examples from the past about how faithful he is. The question isn't whether God will be faithful. The question is whether we will be faithful until we see the results, which we may not even live to see. Will you be faithful when everything goes wrong? Will you be faithful when violence seems to be the winning course? Will you be faithful when wrongdoing and strife and greed and selfishness surround you on every side? Will you, like Habakkuk, in steadfast faithfulness in the midst of his broken world, stand up and declare, this is the very end of chapter 2, the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him. How many of you have heard that verse before? Just raise your hand. I've heard it too. In fact, we sing a song about it. I didn't tell Tommy to sing it. He didn't mess up. I didn't tell him I was getting this far. But I'm moving fast. You can see how fast I'm moving here. The Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silent before him. So yeah, we've heard it. We sing the song about it. We've heard these lyrics. And it's Habakkuk saying, Lord, I don't know what's going on. This world is a scary place. It feels like it's against me. It feels like it's against you. It feels like it's against everything you stand for. Lord, I see the brokenness. I see the pain. I see the suffering. I see the hurting. Lord, I see the apparent victories of the wicked and the greedy and the selfish and the violent. Lord, I see all of that. And yet, I believe you are still to be honored and worshiped. And even though I want you to fix this right now, I believe that you are in your temple and all of us should be patiently silent before you until you do. Now again, you've probably heard this before. I like the song that we sing and I appreciate the sentiment, but it wasn't until I saw this verse sitting right here in Habakkuk, right here in the midst of the destruction, right here as the nation is crumbling around him, here in the midst of fear and uncertainty. It wasn't until I saw it sitting here that I understood the power of this declaration. Brothers and sisters, we live in uncertain times. There is no doubt about it. I'm not questioning that. We talked a little bit last week about the dangers of diving in social media and in cable news networks and how their job is to scare you. We talked about that. And I get why people are drawn to that. We want to be informed. But sometimes, you know, it gets the best of us. But even setting all that aside, we live in uncertain times. Like the hundreds of generations who have gone before us, we live in uncertain times. I don't know what's going to happen today. Like later today. I certainly don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I have no clue what's going to happen in the election on Tuesday. I have no clue what's going to happen in the courts before and after the election. I have no clue about the outcomes or what's coming. I don't know. And frankly, there's not anything else I can do about it. So it feels like uncertain times. I don't know what's going on today. I don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. We don't know God's plans for our own families. My kids are getting ready to graduate from college, or one of them is. One of them prayerfully will in a little while. But I got one that's getting pretty close. I don't know what he's going to do. I know what he thinks he's going to do. But I know that what he thinks he's going to do has changed about a half a dozen times in the last two or three years. Right? I don't know what God's plans for my family are. I don't know what God's plans for Forest Mill are. And sometimes it felt like we're going this way and something happens and we take a sharp left turn, right? It feels like we've set our course and then something happens and then we just got to change course because that's not the way the wind's blowing anymore. God changes our plans. So I don't know what's going on with my family. I don't know what's going on with our church. I certainly don't know what's going on with our nation. This is way bigger than, you know, hundreds of millions of people. Maybe God will fix it all now. Maybe God's going to fix it down the road. Or maybe God has something else entirely planned. Maybe God's going to treat his church in America the way he treated his people of Judah. But whatever the outcome may be, we are called to be faithful to him. We are called to live with God in the chaos. It's not my inclination. I'm not a neat freak by any stretch of the imagination. But I don't like it when there's like stuff everywhere, you know? Like it can be dirty. I don't care if it's dirty. I just don't want the stuff everywhere, you know? I don't like it when there's shoes and socks and blankets that are just kind of scattered around. I mean, I'll pick it up. The floor could be dirty. That's fine. I just don't want the chaos. And so when we look out at the world, we're like, we see the chaos. My first inclination is I need to go fix that. But sometimes there's more stuff than I can do. I want to fix it all. I want it to be fixed right now. So I'm just going to go do it. Let's just fix it up right now. And then I dive in. I'm like, wait a minute. I didn't realize this was 10 feet deep. We come to God and we say, God, we want you to fix it right now. But even when he doesn't, will I be faithful to him? Will I live with God in this chaos? Will I sit in patient silence until he responds? Will I endure? Will I worship with the assuredness that God is still in his temple and worthy to be praised? Will I know, despite all appearances out there, that God is still in control and he still has a plan? Brothers and sisters, it may feel like your life is part of that chaos, that it has spun out of control, that there's things beyond what you can do and you don't know what to do and you're just overwhelmed. And I'm here to tell you this morning, God has a plan for you. You specifically. That God has a plan for you. And that might involve cleaning all this up right now, but sometimes that plan is just walk with me. Just walk with me in your chaos, and we'll just see how it goes. My prayer for you, my prayer for us as a congregation, is not that we'll always get everything out there cleaned up, much as we want to, but that we will walk with God in the midst of our chaos. That we will be faithful to him despite not knowing where we're going. And that we will lean on him for our understanding and guidance. If we can pray for you this morning, lift you up, encourage you for forgiveness, for strength, whatever it may be, we want you to come now as we stand and as we sing.